August 21st, 2025. Hey, future me. I was driving this morning, slowly drifting between thoughts of me, of now, of what's ahead. I saw myself far away, ahead maybe, but alone, without the gym people who became my joy, without the friends I laughed and cried with, without the family who shaped every day of my life. How would I feel then? Happy or unbearably sad? Then I saw myself here, close to you, everyone, maybe finally settling down. But then I wondered, would that mean being left behind? Would it mean giving up on the dreams I carried in my heart for so long, on the life I once imagined, on the impact I wanted to make, on everything I've ever wished for? Would it mean I was simply too afraid of discomfort, too afraid to truly move forward? And in all of that, the question remained, what should I do? And here's an answer from my future self. August 22nd, 2025. Hey, babe, you've lived through so much already. You've met incredible people. You've loved. You've hurt. You've cried. You've laughed. You've made mistakes and you've grown. And the only reason you made it this far is because you learned to focus on the now. On the present moment, on the very step right in front of you. I know the future feels blurry, but that's exactly how it should be. Blurry means it's not time yet. Blurry means don't overthink it now. Blurry means keep your eyes on what's clear today. Work with what you have now. And most importantly, live and enjoy it. Because the present is all you really have. It always has been. So here's what I'll tell you. Work hard. Keep your doors and windows open. Prepare yourself so when opportunities come, you're ready. But don't forget the little things. Don't forget the people who are here with you right now. Loosen up sometimes. Laugh a little louder. Don't take life too seriously, bae. Love you. Always. Forever proud of you. Your hero. Me. Here's where I'm standing these days. Somewhere in between choices I can't seem to make. Fears of losing the people I love, the ones who love me. And the fear of leaving behind my dreams, of giving up on them altogether. Just a month ago, things looked so different. Those choices and fears, although there, were barely visible. Hidden behind the stress, the focus, the exhaustion. I was completely drained. Here's a letter from that time. July 28th, 2025. Hey, future me. Today I'm just tired. Completely drained. It feels like one more day of the same routine, the same pressure, the same silent fear that maybe it's not enough. Maybe I'm not enough. Maybe I won't make it. Will bring me down. I feel like I'm just one step away from breaking. I'm just tired. And that's all I have in me right now. I was preparing for the last exam I'll ever take as a medical student. The end of 6 years of intense studying, brutally busy schedules, painful experiences, and the constant question of whether I was good enough, whether I ever would be, whether I had even made the right decisions. I was exhausted and terrified, afraid that this final exam, after all these years of hard work, after, alhamdulillah, reaching the best places, achieving the best marks, would be the one I'd fail. I was so close to the finish line, yet so scared of stumbling right before it. This is a depiction of those feelings written the day before my last exam. A letter from my future self. July 29th, 2025. Hey, bae, here we are. Tired, at the edge of giving up. Smudged with dirt, soaked in pain. But we've worked hard, really hard, to get here, to this exact moment, the eve of the end, or something like that. It's scary, it's exciting, it's confusing, it's new. Tomorrow, inshallah, you'll walk into that room and ace the last exam you'll ever take as a medical student. And you will never live that day again. Not in the same way, not with the same heartbeat, the same eyes, the same weight on your shoulders. So please, let go of the fear of messing up the last one. Let go of the what-ifs, the maybes, the I should have studied more that are chasing you tonight. Focus on this moment, on which you're living right now, because this might be the last time you live it exactly this way. I'm praying for you, Dunya. For you and for every soul sitting in that room tomorrow. Love you. Always. Forever proud of you. Your hero. Me. And I did. I took that exam. I paid attention to the weight of it being the last. And I passed with flying colors, alhamdulillah. For the first time in years, I finally felt free. Free after endless hours of studying, after burnouts, doubts, and sacrifices. Free after constantly pushing aside the things I enjoyed. The dreams I kept postponing. This is the letter I wrote on the day it was all finally over. July 30th, 2025. Hey future me. Today I'm done. Done with the stress. Done with the waiting. Done with whatever it was that held me back. From doing. From living. From resting. From simply sleeping. Today I'm finally free. A free woman after 6 long years of work. Of studying. Of holding it all together. Of emotional storms I couldn't always name. Of pain I often smiled through. But am I really free? Or is this just the first step into something harder? Or something better? Is this the beginning of the end? Or the end of the beginning? Whatever it is. Today I let myself breathe. Today I let myself feel it. Relief. Release. Freedom. Today I made it, alhamdulillah. And for now, that's more than enough. And after that, alhamdulillah, I had the chance to go to one of the most beautiful welcoming cities I've ever known. London. It was incredible. A place where it didn't matter who you were or where you came from. You were welcomed. Welcome to live there, to experience its rhythm, its beauty, its endless possibilities. To belong. These are some of the things I felt there, the lessons I learned, and the decisions that London inspired me to carry into the rest of my life. August 3rd, 2025. London. Hey, future me. I'm sitting here enjoying this beautifully healthy breakfast. Watching the quiet magic of a London morning unfold through a window framed by red brick walls. And I can't help but wonder, what is it about the city that makes my heart skip a beat? That makes me want to stay, to work harder just to belong here? Is it the soft elegance of the street? The charm of posh cafes? The way music spills out into the sidewalks on a Saturday night? Maybe. But I think it's something quieter than that. It's in the crowd. The girl with the blonde curls walking alongside her friends, each one a different shade of the world. It's in their voices, different accents, different cultures, but all talking about the same things, laughing about the same jokes, learning from one another like it's the most natural thing. It's in that unspoken unity. People dancing under the same sky, hearts beating in rhythm. Languages blend into music. That's what I want, Dunya. To live in a place like this. Not just to exist in it, but to grow in it. To meet the world as it truly is and let it change me gently into who I was always meant to become. Here's another one about the things I've learned there. And today, yes, I'm going to spam you with my letters. Hey, future me. I'm sitting here in the English library, looking at a book about how doctors once relied on astrology to practice medicine, things we now consider nonsense. And I can't help but think, we're all going to make mistakes. We'll be fools sometimes. Say things far from the truth. And that's okay. That's progress. Because without trial and error, there's no growth. Without failure, there's no invention. Without daring to look foolish, there's no technology, no future. So try, Dunya. Do the things that seem silly or impossible. Do them anyway. But even with all of that, the questions never left me. What do I really want to do with my life? My 7th year of medical school was about to begin. finally treating patients, finally being a doctor, though still under the guidance of more experienced hands. But beyond that, I had to think a little further down the road, because what I wanted for my future would shape how I spent this year. And the question was, no, the question is, what should I do? Should I stay here in Algeria, close to my family, close to the people I love, close to the community that has stood beside me for 24 years? Serve the country I owe so much to, the country I want to give back to. But if I choose that, it might mean letting go of so many dreams. Dreams of research, of discovery, of development, of learning from the world, of acquiring every piece of knowledge I can. Or should I chase those dreams, pursue the future, the technology, the endless possibilities, and maybe one day bring it all back? But then, what if that choice means letting go of the people who makes my day brighter? And that's where the doubt deepens. What's the purpose? What is the real goal of life, beyond the spiritual one, of course? Is it growth? Learning? Traveling the world and knowing it? Or is it love? Family? Friends? A life built less on ambition and more on connection? And as I sat with those questions, unsure, a brief answer, or what felt like the beginning of one, came to me, sitting on a bench in Hyde Park. And as always, it came to me in the form of a letter to my future self. August 7th, 2025. Hey, future me. I'm staying here for a couple of days, a place where the culture seems to breathe growth into you, where people move forward, hand in hand, where tall business buildings lean over as if smiling, as if offering a hand straight from the sky, whispering, you will work hard, but you will work better. And I realize it's not just about wanting to come here. It's not even about the idea of spending long hours doing the same tasks for others, just in a shinier environment. It's about choice. It's about freedom. The freedom to be here and give my all. The freedom to leave and explore something completely different. The freedom to stay still and do nothing at all. That's what I want my future to be about. Having the choice and the freedom. Always. And in that moment, I understood something about myself. The choice I wanted to make, the path I longed to take, was the one of freedom. Whatever that freedom meant, the freedom to go abroad, to explore, to be ambitious, to create, to achieve incredible things, but also the freedom to come back, to return to Algeria, to stay close to the people I love, and to serve my community in the way only I can. I want the choice, a choice that allows me to chase dreams without losing the roots that shape me, and still to create beauty along the way. Speaking of beauty, I can't help but think I want to end these letters with one about a small, yet extraordinary experience. Trying out the AirPods Pro in an Apple store and the sheer, inexplicable wonder it gave me. Hey, future me. I'm sitting here trying out a pair of AirPods Pro, and it feels like I've stepped into another dimension. I can't hear anyone around me, as if the whole world has been muted. It's just me, my thoughts, and the moment. For the first time in a while, I feel undisturbed. I can focus, I can create, I can breathe. And in this quiet bubble, it hits me. This is exactly the kind of magic I want to bring into the world. This feeling, this freedom, this sense of humility, this sense of possibility. I want to be part of something like this. I want to build it, shape it, share it. Not just once, but for the rest of my life. I had an incredible time, alhamdulillah, and I suppose it only proves something I've long felt. The importance of traveling, of stepping out into the world, exploring new places, anywhere, everywhere. Because travel changes you, it opens your mind, reshapes the way you see things, and teaches you truths about yourself, about others, about life, truths you might never grasp otherwise. So if I could raise a toast in this episode, it would be this. Here's to traveling the world and experiencing it fully with curiosity and wonder. I hope each and every one of us finds the chance to wander, to collect experiences, to gather stories and lessons we can carry into our own lives, and hopefully share to enrich the lives of others. But today's episode isn't about travel. It's about influence, persuasion. For the longest time, I felt naive, too easily swayed by those around me, by the media, by TV. I believed what I was told, without questioning, without examining, without pausing. I went with the wave. As a teenager, I wanted the expensive phones and clothes that everyone else flaunted. As I grew older, I felt the pressure to follow the milestones everyone else followed: marriage, success, approval, without even asking myself if it was truly what I wanted, or if I was ready. I realized slowly, painfully, that I had been living under the influence of my environment in ways I didn't fully understand, and I decided to change that, to learn, to grow. I knew my hero would be someone unshakable, someone who couldn't be fooled easily. And so I picked up a book, one of the best on the subject, the one Charlie Munger himself called the book he gives most often as a present, his top recommendation, Influence: The Psychology of Persuasion by Robert Cialdini. I can admit it freely now. All my life, I've been a patsy. For as long as I can recall, I've been an easy mark for the pitches of peddlers, fundraisers, and operators of one sort or another. Probably this long-standing status as sucker accounts for my interest in the study of compliance. Just what are the factors that cause one person to say yes to another person? And which techniques most effectively use these factors to bring about such compliance? I wondered, why is it that a request stated in a certain way will be rejected, while a request that asked for the same favor in a slightly different fashion will be successful? Although there are thousands of different tactics that compliance practitioners employ to produce yes, the majority fall within 7 basic categories. Each of these categories is governed by a fundamental psychological principle that directs human behavior, and in so doing, gives the tactics their power. The book is organized around these 7 principles, 1 to 8 chapters. The principles, which are reciprocation, liking, social proof, authority, scarcity, commitment and consistency, and unity. In this episode of the podcast, we're only going to cover reciprocation. Let's go. A while ago, I read about a study that gave volunteers an energy drink designed to increase mental abilities. Some volunteers were charged the retail price of the drink, $1.89. Others were told because the researcher had made a bulk purchase, they'd have to pay only 0.89. Both groups were then asked to solve as many mental puzzles as they could in 30 minutes. I expected the second group, feeling good about the price break, would have tried harder and solved more problems. Wrong, the opposite occurred. The outcome put me in mind of a phone call I had received years earlier. The call came from a friend who had opened a native Indian jewelry store in Arizona. She was giddy with a curious piece of news. Something fascinating had just happened, and she thought, as a psychologist, I might be able to explain it. The story involved a certain allotment of jewelry she had been having trouble selling. It was the peak of the tourist season. The store was unusually full of customers. The pieces were of good quality for the prices she was asking, yet they had not sold. The night before leaving on an out-of-town buying trip, she scribbled an exasperated note to her head saleswoman: everything in this display case at half the price, so 1/2, hoping just to be rid of the offending pieces, even if at loss. When she returned a few days later, she was not surprised to find that every article has been sold. She was shocked, though, to discover that because the employee had read the 1/2 in her scrolled message as a 2, the entire allotment had sold out at twice the original price. That's when she called me. I thought I knew what had happened, but told her that if I were to explain things properly, she would have to listen to a story of mine. Actually, it isn't my story. It's about mother turkeys. Etiologists, researchers who study animal behavior in the natural environment, have noticed that among many animal species, behavior often occurs in rigid and mechanical patterns, called fixed action patterns. These mechanical sequences are noteworthy in their similarity to certain automatic click and run responses by humans. For both humans and subhumans, the automatic behavior patterns tend to be triggered by a single feature of the relevant information in the situation. This single feature or trigger feature can often prove valuable by allowing an individual to decide on a correct course of action, without having to analyze carefully and completely each of the other pieces of information in the situation. This parallel form of human automatic action is aptly demonstrated in an experiment by Harvard social psychologist Alan Langer. A well-known principle of human behavior says that when we ask someone to do us a favor, we will be more successful if we provide a reason. People simply like to have reasons for what they do. Langer demonstrated this unsurprising fact by asking a small favor of people waiting in line to use a library copying machine. "Excuse me, I have 5 pages. May I use the Xerox machine because I'm in a rush?" The effectiveness of this request plus reason was nearly total. 95% of those asked let her skip ahead of them in line. Compare the success rate to the results when she made the request only. "Excuse me, I have 5 pages. May I use the Xerox machine?" Under those circumstances, only 60% of those asked complied. At first glance, it appears that the crucial difference between the two requests was the additional information provided by the words, "because I'm in a rush." But a third type of request tried by Langer showed that this was not the case. It seems that it was not the whole series of words, but the first one, "because," that made the difference. Instead of including real reason for compliance, Langer's third type of request used the word "because" and then added nothing new, merely restated the obvious. "Excuse me, I have 5 pages. May I use the Xerox machine because I have to make some copies?" The result was that once again nearly all, 93%, agreed, even though no real reason, no new information was added to justify their compliance. The word "because" triggered an automatic compliance. Consider the strange behavior of those jewelry store customers who swooped down on an allotment of pieces only after the items had been mistakenly offered at double their original prices. The customers, mostly well-to-do vacationers with little knowledge of turquoise, were using a standard principle, a stereotype, to guide their buying: expensive equal good. In fact, automatic stereotyped behavior is prevalent in much of human action because in many cases it is the most efficient form of behaving. And in other cases it is simply necessary. You and I exist in an extraordinarily complicated stimulus environment. To deal with it, we need shortcuts. The profiteers can commission the power of these principles for use against their targets while exerting little personal force. An example is in order. There is a principle in human perception which affects the way we see the difference between two things that are presented one after another. If the second item is fairly different from the first, we tend to see it as being more different than it actually is. So if we lift a light object first and then lift a heavy object, we estimate the second object as being heavier than we would have estimated it if we have lifted it without first lifting the light one. Relatedly, if we are talking to an attractive individual at a party and are joined by a comparatively less attractive one, the second will strike us as being less attractive than he or she actually is. Be assured, the nice little lever of influence provided by the contrast principle does not go unexploited. The great advantage of the principle is not only that it works, but also that it is virtually undetectable. Retail clothiers offer a good example. Suppose a man enters a fashionable men's stores to buy a suit and a sweater. If you were the salesperson, which would you show him first to make him likely to spend the most money? Clothing stores instruct their salesperson to sell the costly item first. Common sense might suggest the reverse. If a man has just spent a lot of money to purchase a suit, he might be reluctant to spend much more on the purchase of a sweater, but the clothiers know better. They behave in accordance with what the contrast principle advises. Sell the suit first, because when it comes time to look at sweaters, even expensive ones, their prices will not seem as high in comparison. Presenting an inexpensive product first and following it with an expensive one makes the expensive item seem even more costly, hardly a desirable consequence for sales organizations. Here's another great example of the contrast principle. Dear Mother and Dad, since I left for college, I have been remiss in writing, and I am sorry for my thoughtlessness in not having written before. I will bring you up to date now, but before you read on, please sit down. You are not to read any further unless you are sitting down, okay? Well then, I am getting along pretty well now. The skull fracture and the concussion I got when I jumped out the window of my dormitory when it caught on fire shortly after my arrival here is pretty well healed now. I only spent 2 weeks in the hospital and now I can see almost normally, and only get those sick headaches once a day. Fortunately, the fire in the dormitory in my jump was witnessed by an attendant at the gas station near the dorm, and he was the one who called the fire department and the ambulance. He also visited me in the hospital, and since I had nowhere to live because of the burnout dormitory, he was kind enough to invite me to share his apartment with him. It's really a basement room, but it's kind of cute. He is a very fine boy, and we have fallen deeply in love, and are planning to get married. We haven't got the exact date, but it will be before my pregnancy begins to show. Yes, Mother and Dad, I am pregnant. I know how much you are looking forward to being grandparents, and I know you will welcome the baby and give it the same love and devotion and tender care you gave me when I was a child. The reason for the delay in our marriage is that my boyfriend has a minor infection which prevents us from passing our premarital blood tests, and I carelessly caught it from him. Now that I have brought you up to date, I want to tell you that there was no dormitory fire, I did not have a concussion or skull fracture, I was not in the hospital, I am not pregnant, I am not engaged, I am not infected, and there is no boyfriend. However, I'm getting a D in American history and an F in chemistry, and I want you to see those marks in their proper perspective. Your loving daughter, Sharon. Sharon may be failing chemistry, but she gets an A in psychology. Let us now start with the first principle from this book, which is reciprocation. A few years ago, a university professor tried a little experiment. He sent Christmas cards to a sample of perfect strangers. Although he expected some reaction, the response he received was amazing. Holiday cards addressed to him came pouring back from the people who had never met nor heard of him. The great majority of those who returned a card never inquired into the identity of the unknown professor. They received his holiday greeting card. Click and wear, they automatically sent one in return. While small in scope, this study nicely shows the action of one of the most potent of the weapons of influence around us, the rule for reciprocation. The rule says that we should try to repay in kind what another person has provided us. There is no human society that does not subscribe to the rule. Although obligations extend into the future, their span is not unlimited, especially for relatively small favors. The desire to repay seems to fade with time, but when gifts are of the truly notable and memorable sort, they can be remarkably long-lived. To understand how the rule for reciprocation can be exploited by one who recognizes it as the source of influence it certainly is, we might closely examine an experiment performed by Professor Dennis Reagan of Cornell University. A subject who participated in the study found himself rating, along with another subject, the quality of some paintings as part of an experiment on art appreciation. The other rater, we can call him Joe, was only posing as a fellow subject and was actually Dr. Reagan's assistant. For our purposes, the experiment took place under two different conditions. In some cases, Joe did a small, unsolicited favor for the true subject. During a short rest period, he left the room for a couple of minutes and returned with two bottles of Coca-Cola, one for the subject and one for himself. In other cases, Joe did not provide the subject with a favor. He simply returned from the 2 minutes break empty-handed. In all other respects, however, Joe behaved identically. Later on, after the paintings had all been rated and the experimenter had momentarily left the room, Joe asked the subject to do him a favor. He indicated that he was selling raffle tickets for a new car, and that if he sold the most tickets, he would win a $50 prize. Joe's request was for the subject to buy some raffle tickets at 25 cents apiece. Without question, Joe was more successful in selling his raffle tickets to the subject who had received his earlier favor. Apparently feeling that they owed him something, these subjects bought twice as many tickets as the subject who had not been given the prior favor. One of the reasons reciprocation can be used so effectively as a device for gaining another's compliance is its power. Some evidence of how the rule's force can overpower the influence of other factors that normally determine whether a request will be complied with can be seen in a second result of the Regan study. Regan was also interested in how liking for a person affects the tendency to comply with that person's request. To measure how liking towards Joe affected the subject's decision to buy his raffle tickets, Regan had them fill out several rating scales indicating how much they liked Joe. He then compared their liking responses with a number of tickets they had purchased from Joe. There was a significant tendency for subjects to buy more raffle tickets from Joe the more they liked him. But this alone is hardly a startling finding. Most of us would have guessed that people are more willing to do a favor for someone they like. The interesting thing about the Regan experiment, however, is that the relationship between liking and compliance was completely wiped out in the condition under which subjects had been given a Coke by Joe. For those who owed him a favor, it made no difference whether they liked him or not. They felt a sense of obligation to repay him, and they did. I had a similar, though less momentous, personal experience a few years ago, at the start of a cross-country flight. I was assigned an aisle seat in a row of three. Even though I preferred the aisle, I switched seats with a man in the window seat who said he was feeling claustrophobic about being pinned next to the wall for 5 hours. He expressed profound things. Rather than doing what I'd been taught to do all my life and dismissing the favor falsely as too trivial to worry about, I said, "Oh, I'm sure you'd do the same for me." He assured me I was right. The rest of the flight was amazing. The two men next to me began conversations that revealed how much they had in common. I could tell friendship was budding. Yet whenever the men on the aisle had something to offer us, cashews, gum, the sports section of the newspaper, he offered it to me first, sometimes pushing it right past the face of his new pal. I remember thinking, wow, it didn't matter which of us he was sitting closer to, or had more in common with, or was talking to. I was the one he owed, and that mattered most. I also thought that if I were to give advice to someone who'd just received thanks for a meaningful favor, I'd warn against minimizing the favor in all too common language that disengages the influence of the rule of reciprocation. No big deal, don't think about it. I would have done it for anybody. Instead, I recommend retaining that earned influence by saying something such as, "Listen, if our positions were ever reversed, I know you'd do the same for me." The benefits should be considerable. Various types of organizations have learned to employ the power of small gifts to spur actions that would have been otherwise withheld. Similarly, food servers have learned that simply giving customers a candy or mint along with their bill significantly increases tips. And in a restaurant frequented by international tourists, this was the case no matter the nationality of the guests. Despite the impressive force the rule of reciprocation commands, there is a set of conditions that magnifies that force even more. When the first gift is customized, and thereby personalized, to the recipient's current needs or preferences. Research done in a fast food restaurant reveals the effectiveness of this sort of tailoring. Some restaurant visitors were greeted warmly as they entered. Others were greeted warmly and given a gift of a nice key ring. Compared to visitors given no gift, they purchased 12% more food, all in keeping with the general rule of reciprocation. A third sample of visitors was greeted warmly and given a small cup of yogurt. Even though the retail value of the yogurt equaled that of the key ring, it increased food purchased much more, to 24%. Why? Because visitors entered with a need for food and matching the gift to the need made the difference. Earlier, we suggested that the power of the reciprocity rule is such that by first doing us a favor, strange, disliked, or unwelcome others can enhance the chance that we will comply with one of their requests. However, there is another aspect of the rule, besides its power, that allows this phenomenon to occur. Another person can trigger a feeling of indebtedness by doing us an uninvited favor. Recall that the rule only states that we should provide to others the kind of actions they have provided us. It does not require us to have asked for what we have received in order to feel obligated to repay. Little wonder, then, that the influential French anthropologist Marcel Mauss, in describing the social pressures surrounding the gift-given process in human culture, can state, there is an obligation to give, an obligation to receive, and an obligation to repay. Let's re-examine a pair of earlier examples to get a sense of how the process works. First, let's return to the Regan study, where we find that the favorite causing subjects to double the number of raffle tickets purchased from Joe was not one they had requested. Receipt of that Coke produced an indebtedness that manifested itself clearly when Joe announced his desire to sell some raffle tickets. Notice the important asymmetry here. All the genuinely free choices were Joe's. He chose the form of the initial favor, and he chose the form of the return favor. The rule of reciprocation applies to most relationships. However, in its purest form, an equivalent exchange of gift and favors, it is unnecessary and undesirable in certain long-term relationships such as family or established friendships. In these communal relationships, what is exchanged reciprocally is the willingness to provide what the other needs when it is needed. Under this form of reciprocity, it is not necessarily to calculate who has given more or less, but only whether both parties are living up to the more general rule. There is a second way to employ the reciprocity rule to get someone to comply with a request. A personal experience I had a few years ago gave me firsthand evidence of how well this compliance technique works. I was walking down the street when I was approached by an 11 or 12-year-old boy. He introduced himself and said that he was selling tickets to the annual Boy Scout Circus to be held on the upcoming Saturday night. He asked if I wished to buy any at $5 apiece. Since one of the last places I wanted to spend Saturday evening was the Boy Scouts, I declined. Well, he said, if you don't want to buy any tickets, how about buying some of our big chocolate bars? They're only a dollar each. I bought a couple and right away realized that something noteworthy had happened. I knew that to be the case because A, I do not like chocolate bars, B, I do like dollars, C, I was standing there with two of his chocolate bars, and D, he was walking away with two of my dollars. The general rule says that a person who acts in a certain way toward us is entitled to a similar return action. We have already seen that one consequence of the rule is an obligation to repay favors we have received. Another consequence of the rule, however, is an obligation to make a concession to someone who has made a concession to us. Because the rule for reciprocation governs the compromise process, it is possible to use an initial concession as part of a highly effective compliance technique. The technique is a simple one that we can call the rejection-then-retreat technique. Suppose you want me to agree to a certain request. One way to increase your chances would be first to make a larger request of me, one that I will most likely turn down. Then, after I have refused, you would make the smaller request that you were really interested in all along. Provided that you have structured your requests skillfully, I should view your second request as a concession to me and should feel inclined to respond with a concession of my own. The only one I would have immediately open to me, compliance with your second request. Strangely enough, though, it seems that the rejection then retreat spurs people not only to agree to a desired request, but actually to carry out the request and finally to volunteer to perform further requests. What could there be about the technique that makes people who have been duped into compliance so bewilderingly likely to continue to comply? First is responsibility. Those subjects facing the opponent who used the retreating strategy felt most responsible for the final deal. It appeared to these subjects that they had made the opponent change, that they had produced his concessions. And the second one is satisfaction. Even though on the average they gave the most money to the opponent who used the concession strategy, the subjects who were the targets of this strategy were the most satisfied with the final agreement. It appears that an agreement that has been forged through the concessions of one's opponent is quite satisfying. Our best defense against the use of reciprocity pressures to gain our compliance is not systematic rejection of the initial offers of others. Rather, we should accept initial favors or concessions in good faith, but be ready to redefine them as tricks should they later be proved as such. Once they are redefined in this way, we should no longer feel a need to respond with a favor or concession of our own. We've explored a lot in this episode about influence, about the subtle ways people use compliance to use serious towards what they want. We've looked at human nature, at the ways we can be shaped without even realizing it. And so I'd like to close this episode with one final letter. August 25th, 2025. Hey, future me. I'd love to be able to forgive everything, every day, to understand the acts of people around me, the good and the bad, to stay humble, to not get mad, to not hurt the people who hurt me, to love them no matter what they do, because I chose to love them, for they're beautiful and they're ugly. But I'm scared, because if I do that too many times, if I keep forgiving without limits, I might start underestimating myself. I might start treating myself cheap. I might give people the chance to undervalue me, not end up hurt. I want to take care of people. I want to love unconditionally. But I also know at some point, I'll have to love myself too, because no one else can do that for me. So I'll forgive, freely, but never at the cost of forgetting my own worth. That is where I'll leave it. If you haven't yet subscribed to the podcast or YouTube channel, I'd really appreciate it if you did. Your support goes a long way in motivating me to keep chasing my hero and sharing this journey with you. Thank you so much for tuning in. And until next time, take care and keep chasing your hero.